not dissident discourse. It can only be millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial X. We just did a false start. We spoke for about 5 minutes thinking we were on air, and then I realized that we weren't. So sorry about that. Another delay tonight. I do apologize. There are some technical problems tonight. Okay, I am now here with Robin Riley. And Robin Riley has been a regular on Millennial since 2017. She's appeared almost every year. And we have seen in that time her development from the fairly stereotypical millennial lifestyle, globetrotting, traveling the world, finding yourself, and so on. And I think you got disillusioned with that and turned to a more traditional lifestyle. And we have seen in installments the progress of that each year. And it's been a very interesting story, and I think very inspirational. And I hope that a lot of other people decide to follow your example. And so welcome back, Robin.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here. We missed last year, unfortunately, and I was so determined to be here. I didn't want to break tradition again because this is one of my highlights of the Christmas season. So thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Okay, so we're going to talk about the challenges involved in being a parent these days, raising a child in this age. Mm-hmm. And that involves partly protecting them from corruption and also the pause, as we used to call it, and also educating them, because of course a lot of people don't trust the education system, whether state or private. So that's a whole thing in itself. So Robin, take us away on the challenges involved in protecting a child today from corruption.
Well, I think that the targeting of both mothers and children specifically begins in utero. Like the minute that a woman is pregnant, she's bombarded with propaganda normalizing things like abortion. And, motherhood is something that is challenging, even for the women who do it with their whole heart and love every minute of it and, you know, wouldn't have it any other way. Motherhood is challenging. And more so than ever, we are mothering our children isolated and very alone without extended family. And like I said, from the minute that we are pregnant, you know, if you don't want to take the responsibilities that come with motherhood and all of the fear mongering on board that comes with becoming a mom, you know, you can go get your free abortion here in Canada, and that's paid for by the state. It's completely normalized. If you are the kind of woman who goes into the medical obstetrics for a birth, some women have no choice because of complications and health conditions and that kind of thing. But a lot of women will go in with their first pregnancy innocently believing that, you know, this is the safest place to birth their babies. And they unfortunately realize after the fact that it is a business. There is a lot of things that go on in obstetrics that target women as being, you know, they're very, you're never more vulnerable as a woman than when you're pregnant. And babies. I mean, little boys are circumcised within 24 hours of being born. Vaccinations and vitamin K shots happen within 24 hours of being born. C-sections are big business. And unfortunately, you know, if you end up with an impatient doctor or a doctor who doesn't believe in you or who panics during your birth process, you could end up with, you know, abdominal surgery and, you know, a scar on your uterus. So, I mean, right out from the gate, women and children are targeted by a lot of really harmful things. I think can set up the motherhood journey from a place of not feeling confident in yourself as a mom. Now, once your children are born, they're just perfect little cherubic larvae. You don't have to worry about propaganda so much when they're first born, but you still have things, you know, all baby toys are made of plastic. polyester. They spray flame retardants on car seats and prams. Vaccinations are another huge topic, you know, where children are getting absolutely inundated with more vaccinations than ever before. And then if you are unfortunately not able to breastfeed, or you've bought into this idea that breastfeeding and formula feeding are in some way equal, your child from, you know, birth is eating seed oils and all sorts of soy protein, which obviously later in life can cause lots of different health concerns.
See, oddly enough, that was actually when I was born in the early 80s, that was the wisdom that you shouldn't breastfeed. It was that you should use formula. So I was never breastfed. I was entirely on formula. And I have had several health problems throughout life, not serious ones, but who knows, maybe that was a contributing factor. But on the vaccinations, I mean, do you know how many vaccinations that a child gets in a Western country today? Because I've heard like dozens, like there are dozens of diseases dealt with. But is that true?
Yeah, it depends. It depends on where you are. Different countries have different standards for what the vaccine schedule is. I think by age 6 here in Canada, it's upwards of 40 different vaccinations. And now that's not 40 different needles going into your arm, because what they do is they bundle the vaccinations now in like a booster. Back before I was like fully pushed towards the anti-vax side of things, I was first time mom. My husband was not an anti-vaxxer at the time. And we were like, you know, maybe we should get whooping cough. Maybe we should get meningitis, just because those things kind of freaked us out. And we were not informed about the risks involved. And so we asked a pediatrician, could we just get this individual vaccine? And that wasn't an option. The only way to get the whooping cough is if you took a booster that bundled it with like 6 other vaccines, which in my opinion would have been completely unnecessary and super dangerous, because you're not just getting a cocktail in terms of viruses or vaccines. There's also the preservatives and the adjuvants, I think that's what they're called. Like that, there's aluminum and heavy metal preservatives in these boosters, which keep them from spoiling. And that's where you get things like autism and children becoming non-responsive, perfectly healthy children becoming non-responsive after taking some of these like pretty intense boosters. So there's a chart, I think, that you can find pretty easily on Google, where it shows maybe 50 years ago, there was like 8 vaccines that children were getting over the course of their lifetime, but that's like quadrupled.
Even that sounds like that. Even that sounds quite a lot, like 8. Mm-hmm. If you were to ask me, how many vaccinations do you think you'll get in your lifetime? I would have probably thought 4 or 5 in your life.
Totally. But,
when I heard that it was, and 40 doesn't surprise, I heard it was something like that. Yep. And I thought, bloody hell. Mm-hmm. And what must that be doing to the immune system? I mean, I don't know. Has this stuff been thought about? Have they somehow factored that in? Because I don't know how that can not damage or weaken the immune system.
Certainly it does. And I think the fatal assumption that we often make about this side of the medical sector is that they actually are doing this because they want us to be healthy. But it's quite the opposite. They want us to be sick. There's far more money in a population filled with sick, diseased, symptomatic, autoimmune disorder children that can be on medication for life, within the medical system for life, than the alternative. So it's very, in my opinion, evil. It's like pure, it's totally demonic, the entire pharmaceutical industry and what they're doing to target children and mothers.
I think we all got a big dose of that, so to speak, in 2020 21 with the whole COVID thing, because I basically think at this point that COVID was just, and we're not going to go into COVID in any depth, don't worry everyone. But I basically think it was just a bad year of the flu. I think that's what it amounted to. If even that, frankly. I still don't know anyone who was seriously affected by COVID. I've heard of people who were, and their sense of taste was messed up, whatever. I myself was ill for about 8 weeks before, like late 2019. Maybe that was COVID. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But either way, I got over it. And it did take a long time, but I got over it. I'm fine. And this was the case with most people who had it. So basically, I think that entire thing was, it might have had other reasons as well. There might have been other motivations, but I do think they basically got everyone scared out of their wits so that they could sell massive, massive numbers of doses of this vaccine. That's at least one reason why. I mean, as I say, there are probably others, but that's one of them. And I think this shows the sheer ruthlessness of Big Pharma. I think people had heard about this beforehand. They'd have heard conspiracy theories and whatever. But they probably never quite took it seriously until this happened. And then it becomes very close to home in all sorts of ways.
Absolutely. And I mean, so let's say you have been hip to these things. Because lots of people always have been anti-vax and anti-Big Pharma. It was more of a left-wing issue when I was in my 20s, but now the pendulum has kind of swung so that it's more of a right-wing position, which is quite funny to me. But let's say you are hip to these things and you've managed to get around the medical system and you haven't had any physical targeting of your child, but now your child is two. And they're starting to be targeted in terms of their soul and their mind and their hearts. Not just, protecting your children from the like absolute pollution of children focused content that's being produced, and not just online digital stuff. Like the books are they're so low quality. I mean, even back when I was a kid, most books had hand-drawn illustrations. And the poetry was beautiful and actually was quite creative and helped children learn how to read. Whereas now it's like everything is digital. All the images are digitally created. There's just this abundance, this absolute disgusting abundance of horrible, low IQ, children-centered content that you have to kind of try and wade through to find things that are good. And I've had to resort in my homeschooling of my children and finding books, finding a decent movie. I just have to go vintage with almost everything. And I have to buy almost all of our books secondhand. And while that's great, like there is a limit, you know, to what you can find. And if you're going to the library, what's out front and center? It's like me and my two moms, this kind of thing.
It's worth saying, I can remember going to, there was a big bookshop, though there were several big bookshops in Edinburgh, and I can remember going there with my mum in the late 80s and early 90s, and the idea that there would have been a thing there advertising trans or promoting trans gay parenting and all that, there would have been a stand with, like, it's absolutely unthinkable. When you went into that bookshop as a child back then, you were completely safe from certainly that type of corruption. Maybe there were others that are more subtle, but certainly this very overt conditioning simply wasn't there, and it would have been unthinkable. If something like that, if someone had somehow placed a stand like that, or even sold a book like that in an average bookshop in Edinburgh in 1990, there would have been an uproar about it. It's just unimaginable, really, that such a thing would have happened. Whereas now it seems to be the norm.
It is completely ubiquitous here in Canada. It's inescapable. It is the norm. It is celebrated. It is sought after by the vast majority of like normal Canadian people who they've got with the program, they're progressives. They want to give their little children books about normalizing same-sex couples and bringing them to, what is it, trans story hour or drag queen story hour, this kind of stuff. And I mean, that's also very clearly targeting children's minds in a very toxic way. But here in Canada, and I know this is not going to be super relatable for everyone who might be listening from the States, because from state to state, you're going to get a lot of variety. But here in Canada, where it's like very, very liberal, especially where I'm living in British Columbia, it's like everyone is super liberal. even taking my kids to the swimming pool is very scary and precarious. Oh my God. That's terrifying. It's like looking in, it's like a perfect symbol of Canada, except there's too many white children there. There should be like less white children and more diversity. That's what you're missing there.
Sorry to interrupt. I wanted to get that in before you went onto a new topic. But yeah, going swimming.
Oh, so I mean, it's in the female changing rooms. They allow trans people to, like, it's gender neutral changing rooms. So I have gone during the family hours with my children, but like I'm always on alert. Like whenever I'm out in public with my children, I feel like I can never fully relax. The public restroom things is like a reality for moms that are bringing their children into these spaces where, you know, you don't want your children to be encountering these things. It's a very real thing in Canada. And I remember the last time we were there, the last time we went, it was like a family hour swim. So everything was pretty chill. Like the people who were there, it was okay. We're always a minority as a white family. We're almost wherever we go. The diversity here is like exploded. I genuinely do feel like, I don't think that whites are a minority in terms of the demographics in BC yet, but when we go out in public, it feels that way. And I remember one of the teachers was asking, you know, are your kids in swimming lessons yet? You know, here are the different programs. This like overtly gay dude asking me if I'm going to bring my kids in to get them in lessons and stuff. And I'm like, no, you know, I can swim. Like I'm comfortable teaching them myself. And it was like a perfectly polite interaction. But this is the trend, you know, like if it's forest school or t-ball or swimming lessons, there's always at least one super dodgy, sketchy individual who has placed themselves, in my opinion, strategically as an authority figure over children. And it makes finding these sort of extracurricular activities where like your children can socialize with peers or have instruction from an adult who's not you, which I think children benefit from. I always benefited from having mentors and leaders in my life who weren't my parents. It's now off the table for my kids. So they do without a great deal of what public life and community life should be. And that's not even necessarily like propaganda that is being sent out by the state. That's propaganda that has effectively infiltrated the minds of the public, and it's the people in the public who are spreading it amongst themselves, which is like far more sinister and scary of a prospect. Because like, how do you, I mean, you could take books off the shelves. You know, once the public is the problem, that makes it a far more complex problem to navigate.
Yeah. That's almost terrifying. Mm-hmm. Because I can imagine, I mean, this is what countries are for, isn't it? So mm-hmm. that you're in a place where everyone is broadly of the same culture, that, and we're not even talking about multiculturalism here, you are effectively of a different culture than all those other parents. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's but I think, well, this is inevitable, isn't it? If mm-hmm. most people are going to fall for this stuff, then that means that anyone who doesn't is going to be very alienated. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you ever think about moving to America or something?
Of course, all the time. And if we do, so I have, my father is American and he has submitted my application for my American citizenship. Now there's like 200,000 Somalis in line in front of me. So like, I don't know if that's going to be something that is processed with any, like, it's not going to be meaningful probably for our family's timeline. Like right now, like I'm going to have to navigate this situation kind of no matter what, because going back to Europe doesn't feel ideal, because my husband is, he's Slovenian. And so there's a huge language barrier there. Any of the English speaking countries that we could potentially move to feel precarious for all the same reasons that Canada feels precarious. So you're just kind of swapping the same issues essentially, for in lesser or more degrees. it really feels, me and my husband talk about this all the time, you know, should we run? Like, we have this urgency of like, should we flee? But the reality is that there's nowhere left to run. There really isn't. Like, we feel backed into a corner. We are both victims of the secularization of families, in that we both come from kind of broken, dysfunctional families. Extended family is somewhat off the table. I only have one sibling. He only has one sibling. Neither of our siblings are married, so there's no cousins, right? Like, we are very much on our own. And if someday I can move to the States, like, we have a community of people that we know in places in the States that we will effortlessly integrate into. And it will be wonderful if, God willing, that happens someday. But it's, like I said, so far down the line that would be feasible, that we're just trying to cope and survive with where we are right now. Right now, like, we are in one of the, we have paid, like, we pay ridiculous rent to live where we do. But our only real option of feeling safe is to pay to live in a neighborhood where it's mostly like old white retirees who bought their houses like 60 years ago. Now they're like million-dollar homes. And our neighborhood is slowly changing. We've seen it over the past couple of years, but we live on Vancouver Island as well. So we're kind of, there's the ferry as well, which kind of like, it's another barrier. So we've done what we can to put the barriers up around ourselves and to not feel too isolated. But yeah, it's not a situation that feels like we can outrun it, to be honest.
Well, I'm really sorry to hear all of that. It sounds like this is a sort of darkening of the story of your being a parent and living a traditional lifestyle, because the society is changing so fast that it's not going to let you, or it's going to be determined that no child shall escape, and no family shall, no one will be exempt from this program.
Yeah, that's true. And what the really scary thing that I have learned over the past year is that like, even trying to find peers for my kids at church has failed in some circumstances, because the children are in state school or they're in daycare. And like, yeah, it's wonderful if, you know, you are spiritually aligned. I'm an Orthodox Christian, and we go to an Orthodox church here in Canada. And, you know, if you can find a family who is raising their children to be Orthodox, that's wonderful. And it's a huge advantage. But if you're sending those Orthodox children to state school, you are undermining everything that they're learning on Sunday, because their peers are so much more influential than anything else. And I guarantee the vast majority of the peers that they have at these schools will be secular. They will be watching regular TV. They will probably have unlimited internet access, and they will be liberal. So yeah, there's been, I mean, I won't go into detail about it, but there's been a few situations where, like, they've been hanging out with people who we thought were on our level, and the influence that the children had on my children, it was very obviously not good. And it was very, like, it's mind-boggling to me that Christian parents think that, at least in Canada, I know that in the United States, you have a lot more variety and there's a lot more options, and there's even more options for Christian schools and stuff like that. But here in Canada, if you are a Christian parent and you want to try to raise your child in a way that is sheltered from all of this, you cannot consider state schools or even daycare. Like, you can't, it's not an option. And that's another really depressing aspect of this. My children are super social. They're like me. They love to talk. They love being around other kids. And I massively struggle to find peers for them that I don't feel like are undermining the kind of child I'm trying to raise. So yeah, it's bleak.
Make this concrete. What you say, daycare, even daycare would undermine this, the kind of child, the education, the shaping that you're trying to do. How would daycare do? What would they encounter in daycare that would do that?
They watch TV in daycare. A lot of daycares have screen time, and what's put on the screen is just your standard zog slop, like, you know, completely overstimulating, repetitive nonsense, and oftentimes stuff that is overtly liberal at the same time. Also, I think, I'm sure there are exceptions. I'm not trying to shame anyone who's using daycare. I understand there are lots of people out there that have to use daycare in order to survive because of financial situations, yada, yada, yada. I personally, I have my own opinions about that, but I'm not trying to make any parent out there who's listening feel bad about anything because I understand everyone's struggling. But I do believe that there is a very severe fracturing and disconnection that occurs between a child and their parent when they are very, very young and they are dropped off somewhere and left. Many of these children, especially under the age of two, they have no object permanence. So if something is not in their vicinity, it is doesn't exist. And you see videos of this all the time. Parents coming to pick up their small children from daycare, and the minute that their child sees them and makes eye contact, the child is shattered. And they weep and they're like shaken and they're like, it's like all of the emotion of fear and stress that they have felt of being abandoned with a bunch of strangers all day comes out because now my safety person is here. And the shocking thing to me is that people will post this of their kid like, oh, look, you know, this is so silly. This like this child just crying, like he's fine. It's no big deal. But they're missing the deeper underlying situation that's happening there. You are fracturing your connection with your child. And anything that fractures your connection with your child undermines the respect, it undermines the authority that you have over them, and it undermines your ability to influence them. Because that connection, that love, that trust, that feeling of safety is one of the most essential things that I think parents need to protect if they are trying to get them to listen, you're trying to get your child to listen to you and not the outside world. Right. And something as simple, you know, it doesn't seem like it makes any big deal in the moment, but long term, I do believe those things have a dramatic effect on what your child's willingness to trust your opinion on things.
Yeah, because the child will see you as the nutty religious parent, because mm-hmm. that's what they've been basically told you are.
Yeah.
Maybe not directly, maybe directly, yeah. but certainly indirectly. Because that is how our society treats anyone who is, who doesn't conform to this stuff. Mm-hmm. I can see that being a real problem because the child will always be thinking, well, I can be socially acceptable with my friends or I can do what my parents want.
Yeah.
But that then separates me from my friends.
Yeah.
Obviously, children are extremely social creatures. So that's obviously going to play into it. You can see, describing everything that you're saying, you can see why the Amish just separated completely and have remained. I mean, God knows what they must be thinking now. If they hear about this,
they're thinking we were right. I'm happy I'm here, probably. I mean, there's a lot of dysfunction in the Amish communities, depending on where you are. I think there's, because of the insular nature of the Amish communities, you do hear a lot of abuse happening. They are kind of like a parallel society existing alongside ours. And I think while I do agree with you that there is something wise about the way that they have shielded themselves and protected themselves, I mean, they don't have dopamine addictions like we do. They are probably more human in many ways than we are because of the fact that they stopped on that line of technological progress that many of us who are still in this sort of system, even as traditional people, feel enslaved to. So they do have that advantage. But at the same time, I do think that there are issues within that community. I know enough about it to criticize them, to be honest. But like I do know of abuse happening and being covered up within those communities because they are so isolated. And this is the problem. Like I don't want to be isolated. I don't want to have to live this like, you know, Little House on the Prairie LARP. Like I would very much like to be able to be a woman who is a Christian who's living in 2024 without having to resort to these extreme levels of isolation and atomization from regular people, even people who are different than me. But the reality is that, you know, if you want your children to have a chance, you really don't have a choice.
I take what you're saying about this is always the cliche about insular communities, that they're full of corruption and rottenness. I've got to say, that's a Hollywood cliche. I remember that in films in the 90s, which is interesting. Maybe a connection. But I can believe that an insular community will give rise to that, will enable that kind of thing. But again, it doesn't negate the problem that you're talking about, which is that the mainstream is by default and even by law corrupting children.
Totally. I mean,
it's a very, very serious. As I said, I don't know how you would do it, how you would really protect. I think eventually, because there's always the danger that they will just rebel against you when they're like 13, 14. Mm-hmm. They'll rebel against everything that you've taught them. Mm-hmm. Maybe they'll come back round later when they're 20, 23, whatever. There's always that danger. But I guess the point is that in the meantime, you're basically at war with society. And I don't think that this is something that you would ever have wanted to be. I think you're a very open and naturally very trusting person, very social. So this definitely isn't something that you would have sought out.
Definitely not. And when I think about my own childhood, I mean, I was getting dropped off on a bus when I was like 14 years old and driven off to like another part of the province to go to camp with a bunch of kids my own age and adults who were, I mean, like, they were good people. I never suffered any injustice at the hands of the people who were supervising me as a child when I was not with my family. But it's just like such a different world, because I think it's really positive for young children to be given opportunities to exercise their independence and for them to go out into the world and to learn how to navigate it and to, you know, be for there to be conflict and for there to be responsibilities that, you know, mom is not around. So if you don't do it, no one's going to do it for you. I think that makes people strong. And I think that I am going to have to come up with new ways to do that for my kids. And with regard to like the rebellion thing, I am of the mind that I should expect my children to rebel, because I know what I'm like. I know what my husband is like. We are not the kind of people who, like, we think for ourselves. And even if I know I'm right about all of these things, I still need to give my children healthy opportunities to feel this kind of like pushback, this kind of like contrarianness, which I think will be innate to their personality. And if it does happen that the rebellion happens against me, I at least have the peace of knowing that I came back around and that it's possible. And I saw how my parents navigated that situation with me. And I can replicate my own version of that in the hopes that it won't destroy my relationship with them. And then when they figure it out on their own and they feel that victory of I figured it out on my own, which is all children need that. All kids that are coming of age need that feeling of victory of I did it myself. That it won't, the relationship won't be damaged in the process. But yeah, it's so scary. And the responsibility of educating your child is no small thing either. I thankfully do have a background in education, and I worked as a teacher in my 20s. But it's still just, you know, overwhelming. It's so overwhelming to think of all the different ways that, you know, I am going to have to replicate or not manufacture, but seek out music teachers and tutors for certain things, then screen that individual person, have them in my house so that they can learn how to play an instrument and this kind of thing. Whereas like I could just go to school and go to music class. So I don't want my kids to miss out on these essential things. But it's just, there are some days where I'm just like, oh, how am I ever going to be able to manage it all? And how much am I going to fail? Like, because I'm going to fail in some areas. I'm not perfect. I'm doing this for the first time. So there are going to be blind spots that I'm going to have to probably navigate along the way in this. And it's a lot. It's a whole lot to deal with.
Yeah, I can tell. Mm-hmm. With something like... let me think. If your child was to ask you at the age of 7, I mean, presumably you've thought about this. Like, what are you going to say to them about various issues, like gay dads? Well, if your child were to ask you, well, what's wrong with that? Everyone else thinks it's fine. What would you say to them?
So, well, with specifically the issue of homosexuality, I would rely on the church fathers and my faith. Those issues and what's like the issue of homosexuality and sodomy specifically, and what's wrong with those actions, have been articulated in a far more sophisticated way by the church fathers than I probably ever could. So I would rely heavily on my priest's guidance, the church fathers, scripture. And then if they needed, more evidence, I could just pull up some stats on like the medical issues that people who practice homosexuality deal with as a result of a lifetime of practicing sodomy. And also there are quite a few statistics on how homosexuality can be something that's a result of abuse in early life. So it's not something that I would try to break this sort of spell of we are born this way type of thing. And I would use both statistics and my faith to try to expose what is the truth about these actions, that they're destructive. It is not you are born this way type of thing. It is a choice. I would try to be very careful to not use shame and embarrassment for fear of the fact that my child was themselves under some kind of spiritual attack where they were having these thoughts themselves, because I would be afraid that if I was kind of like, these people are all freaks, and I was just kind of dismissive about it, that they would then go into themselves and say, well, this person's not safe to talk about this with, right? So I would try to do my very best to be unemotional about it, and to be historically accurate, and then also in terms of what we know in terms of modern statistics about why these things are bad. And hopefully, I mean, a 7-year-old, I don't know, my son's pretty mature for his age, but I would do my best to make it age appropriate, depending on when the question was asked.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And things like diversity.
We talk about that already with my kids, even at a young age. Oh, how can you not? How can you not? I mean, when it's like my children need to have a sense of identity of who they are. And that is not something that you can just like postpone. Children, even at age 3 and 4, understand I look this way, someone else looks another way. I am my own person, and my family have these traditions that are specific and unique to me. And we don't hate other people, but we know that there are real differences between people. And my little girl just came home. Yes.
Here.
Hi.
I'm back home.
Oh, you came back home. Sorry.
Okay.
I'm watching TV.
You're gonna watch some TV? Mm-hmm. Okay. Go with Daddy. He's gonna turn it on for you. Sorry. They're like running around the house now. They were out looking at the Christmas lights with my husband.
That's fine. The stream was delayed, so I can't complain at all. Yeah. but it's nice to have these little interventions. It was the same with Red Ice.
Yes. I mean, my children are also very blessed to have a European aspect of their identity that, as a Canadian, there's only so much I can be like, this is what it's like to be a Canadian, because like from Canada's inception, it was always a diverse, multi-ethnic place. It was definitely all European, but like it wasn't homogenous in the way that like England or France would be, right? And so my children have been learning Slovenian with their dad since they were babies. He's always spoken Slovenian to them. They have a class that they do once a month where other children who are Slovenian but are living abroad, they all get on a group hangout and they do a craft that's related to Slovenian culture. There was one, we did like a scarecrow windmill thing last month. And we work really hard to nurture that and to help them understand that that's a part of who they are. And there's nothing to be ashamed of. I wouldn't even say there's nothing to be ashamed of, because I wouldn't even want to bring up shame when it comes to identity and ethnicity. I would be trying to nurture pride and understanding of their history and of uniqueness and that kind of thing. And I think the groundwork of laying that foundation for your child's identity should start as early as possible. And I also think they should know that it's not normal for there to be like all these different types of people everywhere. Like, that's not normal. And I tell them that it's not normal, that there are all these people that are coming from other places for nefarious reasons, and they are different than us. And my son can understand that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Of course, I agree with you that the sooner, the earlier, the better. When that, that idea of us, our people, this is us, this is my kind, of course, definitely the earlier the better. Is that something that's undermined by Canadian culture, in like that very idea of there being anything but consumers?
That's a really good question, because that is what it really means to be Canadian. Unfortunately, a lot of Canadian identity is centered around what you consume. It's something that my husband hates. And we are very careful to try not to do that with our kids. But it's also, you know, everywhere. So it's kind of like things will slip in with consumerism and like wanting to buy things all the time, or like getting really fixated on like a thing like Pokemon or whatever. We don't do that, but like he'll hear about it and then he'll like want to zero in on it, right? And then if you were the kind of parent who's like, there's nothing wrong with that, then it's like your whole child's personality becomes enveloped in this consumer product, which has like all these different layers of the show, books, toys, clothing, right? All this crap, right? So we're very, very careful. And what we always say is, and I say this to my four-year-old, like if he wants to do something or he's feeling like he wants to acquire, I will say, we're going to create, we're not going to consume. And I literally say that. And I've nurtured this creativity in him and this inventiveness where he will make his own toys. He'll just like fashion things out of like found objects around the house, and it'll be as good as getting something new. And that's one of the benefits of homeschool, is that, you know, there are endless ways that you can nurture the mind of an engineer or the mind of an artist, the mind of a creative type of individual that is just like, that's completely lost when you go to a state school. That's a really good question.
Yeah, well, another question I would ask is, was actually going to be that, about the difficulty of schooling, of teaching a child. Because it seems to me, and I've said this before, that 13 years, in Britain it's 13 years, 7 years of primary school, and then 6 years of secondary school. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the hell they're doing for 13 years. I don't know what we did for 13 years. Because it seems to me that everything that I needed to learn, I could have learned in 7 years. And it probably would have been faster if I hadn't been in a class with 25 other kids.
Absolutely. I mean, for preschool, which is what my four-year-old son is doing now, it's like 2 days a week, 30 minutes a day of like actual sit down, work with a book, practicing your letters, learning to read, learning phonics, learning maths, learn counting, all this kind of stuff that's more like modeled after what they would be learning in school. But the beauty of homeschool is that I get to curate a curriculum for him. So like for example, my dad was here for a visit just recently, and we have an etch and sketch, which my kids quite love. They have lots of vintage toys, and he was looking for things to do on the etch and sketch because he loved that when he was young. And he was flipping through images of things that people had created on the etch and sketch, and someone had recreated Vincent van Gogh's Starry Night on an etch and sketch. And he was sat with my son, who was four, and he was flipping through. And as that came up, my son said, "That's Starry Night." And my dad was just so wowed by the fact that he was able to recognize a piece of famous art like that, because we have a book on Vincent van Gogh, and we have a book on William Blake, and we have a book of Norse mythology, and we have a book of maps and cartology. And like these don't really seem like topics that would be appropriate for a four-year-old, But what's amazing about homeschool is that you can make any topic age appropriate by simplifying it down to concepts that they can understand, and then you build on it as they get older, obviously. And the amount of what, or like the sort of the complexity of what kids can understand at a young age, I think is really underestimated. It's not just so much that like you're wasting time in this, in schools, that you could have spent less time learning what you needed to learn, but that the really cool stuff, the stuff that, you could have been learning, was just simply never taught to you. It was just never even brought up, not even at an age appropriate time. So that's one thing that, for all of the challenges of homeschooling, especially like with a toddler, like the biggest challenge of homeschooling is like creating a space where my child can focus and concentrate, because I've got a little one who's just like going crazy and screaming and wanting to be involved, but also messing things up at the same time. It's beautiful because I get to nurture my son in a way that I think will be long-term so much more beneficial than even if he was at a school where he wasn't being indoctrinated. I think I could probably do a better job than a state school could because of the issues you outlined.
Yeah. This is a very interesting topic, because it's about how do you communicate knowledge, and how do you encourage the child to work things out for himself as much as possible. I guess. I mean, I suppose that is a dilemma itself. I mean, how much do you intervene and how much do you just leave them alone?
Yep.
Yeah. It must be quite an adventure. I mean, as much as it's, I'm sure, very tiring, it must also be very exciting.
It's totally exhausting. Like, and I don't want to understate the fact that like I did waste my 20s. And so it's not just that, like, in terms of the fertility issues and like I have no fertility issues, but like being an older mom, I turned 36 this year. Being a mom who's in her I'm over my mid 30s now. I'm closer to 40 than I am to 30, which is just awful to think about. But my vitality, my energy levels, my ability to focus is so much less than what it would have been if I was doing this exact same job at 26. And so I'm at a serious disadvantage for like my kid just wants to go all the time. He wants to be outside all the time. And then there are responsibilities with homeschool and stuff. And then I also have my house to take care of, the mundane stuff that I just like, it feels like drudgery, no matter how much I like mind over matter it. It's still mountains of laundry. It's still cooking every day. It's still dishes every day. It's still all of those other things that need to happen. It is absolutely shattering. Like by the end of the day, I just collapse in a heap and I can barely do anything but doom scroll. It's awful.
Right.
But I mean, you do what you got to do, right? Like your love for your kid and your duty to your family, I do get on with it, and everything does get done somehow by the grace of God. But it's not easy. It's so not easy.
Is it worth it?
Absolutely. Totally. When I look at my kid and I see what he's capable of, and see the kind of people that they're becoming, and I think, not to bring up Jordan Peterson, but the part of this whole story was, you know, it began with Jordan Peterson waking me up to the fact that I was a degenerate loser, wasting my life. One of the exercises that I did all the way back, back when we had our first chat on the first millennial, was that I made a little ideal version of myself that I could become if I got my stuff together and I stopped lying to myself and lying to other people around me. And then I did the opposite, which was, where will I be in 10 years if I go on the way I'm going and I keep lying to myself and I keep trying to get away from this responsibility and I keep trying to create meaning superficially rather than working for it. And when I think about where I could have ended up and where I am now, 100%, it's all worth it. Like, I will let myself be crucified every single day for my family. And the joy that I receive in knowing that I made it, like, it's harder for me because of the mistakes that I made. Person who didn't make the mistakes that I made will have an easier go than I think I'm currently having. But, like, that's, like, me paying my dues. Like, I deserve that a little bit. And yeah, 100% worth it. I would never want to go back to my old life ever for any amount of money.
Yeah, I got that feeling. So what would you say to, like, let's say, a 24-year-old woman who was in that lifestyle now?
I would say to do what I just described. Like, if you continue doing what you're doing now, where are you going to be in 10 years? Do you like where that is? If you got everything together that you think that you can't, like, even if you think you can't do it, let's say your ideal scenario and you envisioned the best version of yourself that you could be, if you pulled yourself together and started trying to be honest with yourself and look for meaning through responsibility, and you got right with God, and you started to be honest about the things that you've done wrong and really repent for them and change your ways. I'm not just saying, like, oh, I feel bad for something that I did that was wrong. I mean, actually a change, a movement away from doing things that are wrong towards something that's good. And you ordered your life. Does that not look better to you? And I guarantee that it will. And I mean, if you go back, I'm sure there's a way that people can go back to see where I started. I don't know if it gets, and probably it does get worse than where I started off, but I was not in a good place when I started off my journey. And I do think that I was very lucky to find the husband that I did. I think that would be another huge piece of advice, is that choosing your husband and who is going to be the father of your children is going to be probably the single most important decision that you make on this process. Because if you pick wrong, all your efforts can be sabotaged by the challenges of a relationship that is just not going to work. I was very fortunate that I found someone who I'm compatible with, who I love, who had the same vision as the future with me, who was willing to go through the hardships. And we have had, I mean, like, anyone who's had a newborn knows that it's challenging on your marriage, right? We've gone through the ebbs and flows. And every single time we've come out stronger. And he is also willing to provide. He has the ability in terms of his intellect and the willingness in terms of his stamina to do what it takes to allow me to stay home. Me working is never on the table. And he gave me my freedom to be this mom. Without him, nothing that I'm doing would be possible. Without his support by my side, none of it would be possible. And he's also the spiritual leader of our family. He is a role model for our children in a way that even if I was the best mom in the whole world, I couldn't replace him, right? So decide who you want to be. Be motivated by the vision of who you don't want to be. And choose your husband with great discretion and care. And make sure that it's, like, do what you have to do to make sure that he's the right man before you commit to him. Because I really think that for me, this is going to be maybe a controversial opinion. I think marrying late, I guess it's subjective, marrying later in life to the right person is way better than marrying early to the wrong person.
Oh, yeah. I think that sounds sensible, because, I mean, if you end up with the wrong person, what happens is you end up constantly running into conflict where they are simply not, you have different visions, you have different expectations, you have different desires. So of course, this is an absolutely, I would say it's the most important decision that a woman makes in her entire life, is whom to marry. Yeah. It's absolutely crucial. So that's definitely. Just one more thing. You said before about being honest with yourself. Mm-hmm. What were the delusions? What were you not being honest with yourself about?
So for me, I cared too much about what other people thought of me. And I lied to myself in terms of acting a certain way, doing things that I instinctively felt I shouldn't do, or that I just didn't even want to do, because I was seeking. Actually, even less was I seeking. I was afraid of being alone. I was willing to make myself into whoever I had to make myself into to be accepted by others. Sometimes that was by a boyfriend. Sometimes that was by a peer group. Sometimes that was by a boss. And when you're operating from this foundation of, I don't want to be alone and I'm going to do what I have to do to not be alone, you are creating your whole life in falseness, because that shouldn't be the basis. Yes, sweetheart. Matei, can you please grab the baby? I'm almost done. you're creating your life from the basis of falseness. And it's not something that I would recommend, because I did that for almost a decade. Found myself in a relationship with someone who didn't respect me. I didn't respect them. Sweetheart, I don't want you on camera. Oh, sorry. yeah, I'll just leave it there, because I don't want her on camera.
I understand. Yeah, I understand.
Sorry. Don't worry. Sweetheart, just a second, please, sweetheart.
Sorry. It's okay. Don't worry about it. All right, let's end it there then.
Okay.
I think we've said an awful lot. Yes. It's been good. So we'll just cut it there.
Okay. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
On this anniversary year, a true bounty can be found in the merchandise store. T-shirts, mugs, and an incredible range of posters. All exclusive products. Every one the perfect way to remember this unique time. At the end of the festival, a very special poster will be available. But no need to wait for that. See what you can pick up today.